All right, good evening, ladies and gents. I trust that everybody can hear me, at least somewhat for the moment. Welcome to Dynasties of the Book. It happens to be that so far, Baruch Hashem, I've had the opportunity of giving two such people of the book talks thus far. And to a certain extent, this is the most challenging. Because when discussing a dynasty, one needs to consider biographical sketches and histories of a number of people, trying to understand how a group of people fit into one particular place in history. To do that, what I've done is, as you can see on the screen, I've drawn out somewhat of a timeline and a family tree. The Brisk dynasty, of course, being almost entirely synonymous with the last name Soloveitchik. And what we're going to be doing is zooming into different boxes on the screen, discussing them as they go in order. Now, I must admit that I'm somewhat intimidated to have many, many people in this audience that know a tremendous amount more than I do about the Brisk and Soloveitchik family. Nevertheless, I will do my best to paint a portrait of the Soloveitchik family and the Brisk dynasty, but more importantly, the legacy that they have left behind and continue to have in our lives today. No conversation about Brisk can begin without a conversation of the early generations that happened before the Brisk Revolution, as we will call it later on. The first person to talk about is, of course, Rabbi Eliyahu Kramer of Vilna, commonly known as the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon, living from 1720 to 1797, was a genius, as his name entails, but more importantly, a revolutionary when it comes to learning. Judaism is broken up into different periods of history. The periods of the Egyptian exile, the sojourn of the Jewish people in the desert, entry into the land of Israel, 350 years or so later, the building of the first temple, which stands for about 410 years, destroyed by the Babylonians, beginning Babylonian exile, which lasts for 70 years. Thereafter, return to Israel, under the leadership of Ezra and Nehemiah, the rebuilding of the temple, the second Beit HaMikdash, which is going to last for 420 years, according to most counts. The destruction of the Second Temple in the year 70 CE by the Romans. Roman exile, of course, being what we are still, to a certain extent, living through, from the year 70 until the year 2016. Now, that period of time of Roman exile is, of course, categorized by many different time periods that really almost systematically define the development of halakha, of Jewish law, vis-a-vis the oral tradition. Up until the time of the destruction of the Second Temple, all Torah was written Torah. And all of what we know today as Mishnah, Gemara, Midrash, halakha, Agadata, all of these things were contained within the Torah Shebaal Peh that was passed on from generation to generation orally. Teacher to student, teacher to student. Since Moses, from Moses all the way until Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi that writes down the Mishnah. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's writing of the Mishnah in Israel around the year 150, I think, then is disseminated to the rest of the world, into northern Israel, where it's discussed to become the Talmud Yerushalmi, and sent off to Bavel, where it becomes the Talmud Bavli. After the sealing and the signing of the Talmud Bavli, of course, begins the period of the Gaonim. They were the leaders of the Jewish people, the Talmidei Chachamim, that disseminated the teachings of the Talmud Bavli primarily in the land of Israel as well as in Bavel, which around the year 1000 turns to the time of the Rishonim. Now, the Rishonim are familiar figures to us, much more probably than the Gaonim were. The time of the Rishonim We meet characters like the Rif, Rashi, the Rambam, the Ramban, the Rashba, the Ritva. According to most counts and authorities, the time of the Rishonim ends in about the 1500s with the writing of the Shulchan Aruch by Rav Yosef Kara. Rav Yosef Kara is a resident of Tzfat, and this is the time that Tzfat has its renewal. It's important to recognize that after the writing of the Shulchan Aruch, most Jewish literature and most Jewish study revolved around the study of the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch develops into a major, major work with all of its Nosei Kelim, all of the people, the amazing Gaonei Yisrael and Gedolei Yisrael that are going to write commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch. And they're going to talk about halacha. And they're going to talk about Jewish practice. And in addition to the Shulchan Aruch, there's going to be an overwhelming library of responsa that's written. So we have works on the Shulchan Aruch of halacha, works of shutim, of she'elot tshuvot responsa, written about halacha. And the primary study, to a certain extent, of Jewish scholarship is in the world of halacha, to a certain extent to the detriment of the study of primary sources. People are spending less time focusing on the Talmud itself. Many schools are teaching just the Rif. The Rif is a concise version of the Talmud that picks out the halachic sugyas, the halachic topics. Many schools are teaching just the Rif. The study of Tanakh is exceedingly unpopular. And to a large extent, all of this changes when the Vilna Gaon steps onto the scene. The Vilna Gaon believed in going back to the roots, going back to the study of Talmud, going back to the study of Midrash, going back to the study of Agarata, going back to the study of Tanakh. And while the Gra, the Vilna Gaon himself, writes very little himself, exceedingly concise notes, it is the works of his students and the life of his students that is going to redefine the way that we study Torah today. It should also be noted that the Gra, the Vilna Gaon himself, was exceedingly well versed in all of Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaal Peh, including the Zohar and other works of Kabbalah. It's said that when the Vilna Gaon would edit as he would manuscripts of the Talmud, that he would have 1,000 proofs in both Nigle and Nistar for every change or edit that he made, 1,000 proofs in both the revealed Torah and the hidden Torah for every change that he would make. The Vilna Gaon, to a certain extent, is put on a pedestal in Jewish history and in the world of halacha, in that although he lived in the period of time of the Achronim, the 1700s, he is not shy to debate with the Rishonim. He's not shy to take on the Rashba, the Ritva. Not even afraid to take on the Rambam, and he does in many places. One thing just to throw out there, the Vilna Gaon, based on his knowledge of Kabbalah, disagreed vehemently with the Rambam's view that demons did not exist. He believed, based on Kabbalah, that they did, and had no problem taking on even such figures as great as the Rambam. His Talmid Muvak, his primary student, was a man by the name of Reb Chaim of Volozhin. Reb Chaim of Volozhin, as his name and title indicates, lived in Volozhin and was the founder of the Volozhin Yeshiva. It should also be noted at this point in time, in other places in Europe, there is a massive movement of Chassidut that is building and growing stronger. The Vilna Gaon is vehemently opposed to Chassidut, and it's important to recognize this is not because of his rejection of their mysticism per se, but disagreements because of it. Disagreements within it. And to a certain extent, he teaches the same mystical concepts as are being taught in the world of Chassidut, and we'll see in a moment that they are written down by his student Reb Chaim of Volozhin in his seminal work, The Nefesh HaChaim. When I was in Kerem Yavne, my Rebbe Reb Lachman gave two chaburas. One was a chabura in Tanya, the work of the Alter Rebbe Shneur Zalman of Liadi, and the other was in Nefesh HaChaim, both written roughly around the same time, both dealing with many of the same concepts. I can tell you from my limited study of both that there are more things that they agree on than they disagree on. But nevertheless, as Chassidut is developing in Europe, and I believe the next two dynasty of the book Shiurim will deal with Chassidic dynasties, the dynasty of Brisk is in its nascent form. The seeds have been planted. Reb Chaim of Volozhin lives from 1749 to 1821, and he lives to see the founding of the Volozhin Yeshiva. The Volozhin Yeshiva represents a completely new and distinct way for people to study Torah, primarily because it is, for the first time, a yeshiva. Torah was studied privately in Europe. Primarily, in different towns, there would be people that would teach privately. Small chadarim, small chaburas, different groups of people learning together. But the concept of a yeshiva that would attract young men from all around Europe to learn in one place, where their meals would be provided for them, where they would be able to sit and learn. The concept of sitting and learning was revolutionary. And this was the work of Reb Chaim of Volozhin. Volozhin became known as the mother of all yeshivas, and its students spanned the entirety, the length and breadth of Europe, opening up yeshivas throughout the 1800s and 1900s. Nefesh HaChaim, which has been translated into English. Here's an excerpt. I apologize, I took this from an early edition that was freely available online. Let's read it inside. And from this we'll glean somewhat of an insight of what Reb Chaim of Volozhin was trying to get at when he started his yeshiva. Vehein ata b'deres halalu, and now in our generations, ba'avaneseinu harabim nafoichu, through our sins the world is topsy-turvy. That which is great is downtrodden. So kama v'kama, some call ikar kvias limudam roiv hayamim rak b'sifra yirav musar. He bemoans the fact that most people spend most of their study time learning the works of Yira and Musar, of fear of God and of Musar. Of course, it should be noted that the Vilna Gaon himself held the Ramchal, Rav Moshe Chaim Litzata, the author of Mesilat Yesharim, in incredibly high esteem. Indeed, the Vilna Gaon said, if I would have lived at the same time as him, I would have walked to Italy myself to meet him. Works of Musar are not being put down by the Gra or by Reb Chaim Volozhin. However, Be'omram kizeh kol ha'adam be'olamo la'asok bahem tamid. People say that all a person must do all day is learn the works of Musar. Ki hema malhivim halevavot, asher az yachnia levavo, lachnia ulesaber hayetzer mitavotav. Through this, a person will be able to subjugate his evil inclination and to break his base mundane desires. Ulis yasher b'midas tovus, and straighten himself out with good midot, good attributes. V'keter Torah munach b'keren zavit, and the crown of Torah is lying dormant in the corner. People are ignoring the crown of Torah. U'veinai ra'iti b'prach echad, and with my own eyes, says Reb Chaim of Volozhin, I saw in one place, that this ideology has expanded such in most of their Batei Midrash, in so many places, all that they have is Sifrei Musar. And even one complete set of Shas, of Talmud, they do not have. V'tach einai mirat mehavin v'askil lebotam asher lo zu haderech bachar ba Hashem ki lo yirtze. This is not what God wants. He continues to bemoan the state of Torah. People are leaving the ways of learning. People are not studying Talmud. People are not becoming proficient with their own koichas, with their own abilities to look at primary texts. People that believe that all they need to do is have wonderful character traits, that they do not need to be Talmid Chachamim. So bemoans Reb Chaim of Volozhin. And he founds his yeshiva with the idea, with the concept in mind, to change this. And change it he does. This is an old picture of the yeshiva in Volozhin. There's a whole history to the building, which we don't have time for now. But let's go through the history of the yeshiva. Both exalted and sad. The Volozhin yeshiva lasts for almost 90 years. Most of the 1800s. 1803 to 1862. It's founded in 1803 by Reb Chaim of Volozhin, as we've discussed. He dies almost two decades later in 1821 and is succeeded by his son, Reb Yitzchak of Volozhin. Reb Yitzchak of Volozhin building the yeshiva up until 1849 when he dies and Reb Eliezer Fried is taken over, is taking over the yeshiva. With none other than Reb Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the Netziv, as his assistant Rosh Yeshiva. The mid-1800s sees the Netziv as the assistant. Shortly after, in 1854, Rabbi Fried passes away, and the Netziv becomes the new head of the Yeshiva, the new Rosh Yeshiva. By his side is our next major character, Rav Yosef Ber Soloveitchik. We'll see in the Soloveitchik family, names repeat themselves a significant amount. Rav Yosef Ber Soloveitchik, who is Rav Chaim of Volozhin's great-grandson, is appointed as the assistant Rosh Yeshiva. Now in 1865, Rabbi Soloveitchik, who is later to become known as the Beis Halevi, leaves the yeshiva, which is a story for another time, but effectively to avoid the machlokes of who was really going to be the Rosh Yeshiva, whether it was going to be the Netziv or himself, he becomes the Rav of a place called Slutsk. Shortly after he arrives in Slutsk, Rav Yeshua Leib Diskin, who is the Rav in Brisk, known as the Saraf of Brisk, the fiery angel of Brisk, makes Aliyah. And Rav Yosef Ber Soloveitchik, the Beis HaLevi, is invited to become the head of Brisk, the chief rabbi of Brisk. The Beis HaLevi. And so begins the dynasty of Brisk. He lives from 1820 to 1892. He was known while teaching in Volozhin as a genius in his own right, a phenomenal educator. He is known today for the two sets of books, Beis HaLevi, that he wrote. One is Shailas HaTshuvas, Shut Beis HaLevi, and the other is the Beis HaLevi Al HaTorah. I thought perhaps to get a taste of the Beis HaLevi, would learn a small piece of what he wrote in last week's parasha, Parashas Truma. In this piece, we'll see two things: his incredible sincerity and honesty, as well as his brilliance. Feel free to read along with me. Last week's parasha, Parashas Truma, details the building of the Mishkan. Parashas Truma, of course, comes right after Parashas Mishpatim. And the Beis Halevi wants to know, why is it that Truma comes after Parashas Mishpatim? Parashas Mishpatim, of course, details so many of the laws of being honest in business. Mitzvahs bein adam lechaveiro, making sure not to cheat somebody out of money, making sure to take care of any liability, damages, any problems that a person might encounter. And Parashas Truma is what invites the Jewish people to build the Mishkan. Vayichuli Truma. Says the Beis Halevi as follows: Daber el b'nei Yisrael vayichuli Truma, quoting the Pasuk. Speak to the children of Israel and tell them to take for me a Truma, a contribution. Me'ez kolish asher yedavenu libay, from every person who is of generous heart, tikhu et trumati, from them you will take my truma. Says the Beis Halevi, hine ba parsha zu achrei parshas mishpatim. This parsha comes after parsha mishpatim. Dibitchila kaidim shiase adam tzedaka b'mamonai. For before a person gives tzedaka from his property, gives a truma, tzarech lirai shaloyiye b'mamonai chashash gezel, he must ensure that it is his property to give, that it is not stolen monies. For if it is not so, if it is not his money to give, tzedakah will not help him klal at all. Chamay de lulav hagazel posel mishum mitzvah haba be'avera. Just like a stolen lulav is invalid, for it is a mitzvah haba be'avera. It's a mitzvah that comes through doing an avera, and you can take a look at the rest inside. Such a phenomenal insight. The sensitivity and the brilliance of the Brisker Rav, that's one piece. I'll tell you two stories. Two stories that they tell about the Brisker Rav while he was in Brisk. And we'll see this echoed in the world of Reb Chaim. The Beis Halevi, B'Yashiv Be'er Soloveitchik of Brisk, was known equally for his genius as well as for his kindness, his sensitivity. There's a story that they tell of a poor woman that came to his house to ask the following question. Pesach is coming. Am I allowed to use milk for the four cups? Milk for the four cups. The Beis Halevi goes to his pushka and he takes out a heavy sum, 25 rubles. All good Jewish stories involve rubles. And he gives it to this woman. And then the people standing around say, Rebbe, 2 rubles would have been enough for one. Why you give her 25 rubles? So he says, because she obviously doesn't have meat for the Seder. If she's asking about milk for the Arbakosis, she needs money to buy meat for the Seder. They tell the story that when he arrived in Brisk, he came with, of course, with many pre-formulated halachic opinions. And without going into the details, there is a particular shach. Shach in Yoredeh, commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, that allowed for a certain blemish in a cow to still be deemed kosher. The Beis Halevi disagreed with the shach and believed that such a cow should be treif. So the story goes that the Shaykhid arrives, asking this exact question soon after the Beis Halevi arrives in Brisk. He says to him, is this cow kosher or not? And the Beis Halevi knows. He knows that the Shach says that it's kosher, but he thinks that it's treif. So he says to the Shechet, he says, you should know that I believe that it is treif. And in Brisk, we are going to paskin that this kind of cow is treif. However, the Shach thinks that it's kosher, and I'm the guy telling you that it's treif, I'll pay you for the damages. I'll pay you for the cow. If the Shach says it's kosher and I think it's treif, I'll pay you the difference. You shouldn't walk out of here thinking the Rav of Brisk, the Beis Halevi, is responsible for your lack of funds. Thus far, the Vilna Gaon, Rav Chaim Volozhiner, and the Beis Halevi. And were it to be that Brisk stopped there, we would have known the Beis Halevi as a brilliant genius, a tremendous educator. But the revolution begins in the next generation. The revolution begins with Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, Reb Chaim Brisker, or as he is known in yeshivas, simply Reb Chaim. Reb Chaim is the son of the Beis Halevi. He's a student in Volozhin, where his father once taught. When it comes time for him to marry, he marries the daughter of Rafael Shapiro, who is the son-in-law of the Netziv, the Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin. Rafael Shapiro himself serves as Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin, and after the yeshiva is shut down, he is the one that begins it once again in the late 1800s, but that's a story for another time. With Reb Chaim marrying into the family of the Netziv, he's given a chabura, he's given a study group in Volozhin. And shortly becomes the most popular chabura in the yeshiva. He attracts all of the brightest minds, the smartest people. Everybody is talking about what Reb Chaim is teaching. So much so that he's soon promoted to a shir, and later serves as the Korosh Yeshiva with his wife's grandfather, the Netziv of Berlin. Now, towards the end of the 1800s, the yeshiva is shut down. Again, a story for another time. And Reb Chaim moves to Brisk, where his father is the Rav. Shortly after, his father passes away, and Reb Chaim assumes the position as the Rav of Brisk. Now, we could really spend the rest of this evening and probably the rest of the week discussing Reb Chaim. But since we have more generations afterwards, of course, Baruch Hashem, we're going to limit our discussion somewhat. But we will spend a substantial amount of this talk understanding who Reb Chaim is and the revolution that he made. And we'll divide Reb Chaim's life into two pieces to a certain extent. His days in Volozhin and his days in Brisk. Rabbi Soloveitchik, the Rav, Rav Yashav Ber Soloveitchik, that we know as the Rav, had a small safe in his house where he instructed his children, if there is ever a fire, you take out that safe, that little box. Inside that box was what the Rav considered his most prized possession, the notes of Reb Chaim Shiurim that he gave in Volozhin. Primarily on the Zikin, Mesechtas Baba Kama, and a little bit Baba Metzia. Later on, Rabbi Rakefet writes and speaks about the fact that he put them in a vault. In the 70s, and again in the 90s, they were published and republished, those notes, both in Eretz Yisrael, by the family of Rav Velvel Soloveitchik, and by the Rav's son, Rav Chaim, who we called Dr. Grach, Rabbi Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik. These notes that have been analyzed show the beginnings of Reb Chaim's brilliance, the beginnings of Reb Chaim's nuance, the beginnings of Reb Chaim's derech. But what we would refer to, as Rabbi Rakefet does, as proto-brisk, as nascent brisk. The beginnings of a new way of thinking, the beginnings of a new methodology. Not quite complete. For Reb Chaim's work, his primary work, his primary contribution to Jewish scholarship will be expanded upon primarily as the Rav of Brisk. That's a picture of Reb Chaim. His works are published posthumously 17 years after he dies by his son Reb Velvel Soloveitchik into Chidushei Rabbeinu Chaim HaLevi Al HaRambam. The novel ideas of Rabbi Chaim HaLevi Soloveitchik on the Rambam. Yes?
Just for clarification, Brisk was a town, did they have a yeshiva there that was in charge of, or was he just the chief?
He was the rabbi. He was the rabbi of the town.
There was no yeshiva.
To the best of my knowledge, not to the same extent. There were, of course, people learning, but I am not 100% sure. Brisk is in Belarus, on the border of Poland, I believe. Now, there's a lot to speak about Reb Chaim Al HaRambam. Now, this is Reb Chaim's primary work that was not published by Reb Chaim in his lifetime. And that's a vitally important part to understand. Reb Chaim Soloveitchik publishes nothing in his own lifetime. We're going to need to understand that further. But before we do so, we should focus on the fact that his primary sefer is on the Rambam. To a large extent, the number one contribution of Reb Chaim in the world of Jewish thought and scholarship is the revival of the Rambam. The Rambam, who we revere so much today, was a seldomly studied book pre-Reb Chaim. In the world before Reb Chaim, people learned Rashi, and people learned Tosfos, and people learned the Rif and the Rush, and people learned the Shulchan Aruch and the Tur and the Beis Yosef to a certain extent. But the Rambam was left aside for one very simple reason. Because the Rambam, as those of you that have seen his introduction will know, argues that all that you need to be a good practicing Jew is a Tanakh and a Mishneh Torah of the Rambam. The Bible and the Mishneh Torah. Tanakh to teach you Jewish history, where we come from, and the Rambam to teach you Jewish practice. The Rambam does not include any of his reasoning. Now, a book that doesn't include sources and doesn't include reasoning is an off-putting book to the yeshiva world. It's a closed book. We have no idea why he thought this, when he thought this, how he thought this. And primarily, people assumed that whatever views the Rambam had that were valid were already incorporated into the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch of Yosef Karo was a student of the Rambam, of course, many generations apart. Everything we need from the Rambam is already in the Beis Yosef and in the Shulchan Aruch. And people left the Rambam aside. Reb Chaim HaLevi Soloveitchik is drawn to the Rambam. His entire life's work is on the Rambam. And when pressed, for why he loved the Rambam so, it said that he answered, Dafka, because the Rambam gives no reasons, he allows for so much open thought. Now it should be noted that there is a big debate how to view Reb Chaim Halevi Soloveitchik's Chidushim on the Rambam. Are they an explanation of the Rambam? Are they a way of understanding the Rambam? Or are they simply a platform for Reb Chaim Halevi Soloveitchik to explore and express his own ideas? How much of what he says do we assume the Rambam thought? And these are two different schools of thought. It should be noted that the Sridei Eish, Rabbi Yaakov Yechiel Weinberg, genius of German Jewry, argued that Reb Chaim wrote on the Rambam as a platform. That Reb Chaim was writing his own ideas, writing them into the Rambam, that the Rambam was his platform. The Rambam never thought this way. The Rambam never paskened this way. The Rambam never believed the way Reb Chaim did. They are two separate works. When I was in Yeshiva, my Rebbe Reb Blachman pointed out to us once, along this thinking, a Tshuvas HaRambam. We have a number of works of the Rambam. Of course, Mishneh Torah is the largest. But we have Shailas HaTshuvas that were asked to the Rambam. And he said to us, guys, take a look. Read this Tshuva of the Rambam. And tell me if it sounds like he thinks the way Reb Chaim says he thinks. And it doesn't. It doesn't. Many argue that the Rambam thought one way and Reb Chaim another. And where there are contradictions in the Rambam, and Reb Chaim builds beautiful palaces of intricate logic and textual comparisons, that the Rambam never thought like that, such as the opinion of the Sridei Eish. How the Rambam did think, he doesn't say. Nevertheless, Reb Chaim uses the Rambam to construct magnificent constructs of logic and textual analysis. On the other side, it should be noted that Moreno Rabbeinu of Soloveitchik was strongly of the opinion that his grandfather Reb Chaim explained the Rambam as the Rambam believed. That his entire work was to understand the words of the Rambam as the Rambam would have thought of them, and thus contradictions in the Rambam that we see the Rambam was aware of and thought of rationale, thought of reasoning to explain them, that Reb Chaim Halevi Soloveitchik, the Rav's grandfather, later revealed in Chidusha Reb Chaim. I'll tell you that there is a pshara, there is an in-between. The in-between I heard once from one of my rabbeim, Reb Moshe Stav in Yeshivas Kerem B'Yavna, that the world of the Rambam is slightly more complex. The Rambam in his Mishneh Torah weighs up two realities. One is the Masorah that he has from the Gaonim, the tradition, the transmission of Halakha that he has from his predecessors. And the other is that which he devised with his own logic, that which he understood from the Gemaras. Sometimes that which he was taught in one place logically contradicts that which he learnt in another place. And yet, he knew them both to be true. Says Reb Moshe Stav, it is possible that the Rambam himself never rationalized fully the discrepancies in his work, other than the knowledge that both are true. Though they are contradictory, both are true. He knew that. He knew that what his teachers had taught him was correct, and that which he was learning himself with his own logic, he knew was correct. And the job of Rabbi Chaim HaLevi Soloveitchik is to find that logic that ensures that both of them are compatible with each other. And that would be our psara, our compromise between those two very different opinions on Rabbi Chaim. I will leave it to you to decide which of those three you prefer. I'll give you three stories from the life of Rabbi Chaim. There's a story told that when Rabbi Chaim was the Rav of Brisk, he was exceedingly lenient when it came to Yom Kippur. Whenever people would come to him with questions on Yom Kippur, "Rabbi, am I allowed to break my fast? This problem and that problem," he would be exceedingly lenient. He would tell people to eat regularly, not to wait the shiurim, not to eat in shiurim, small amounts, less than a kezayis. He would tell them not to worry about waiting the time of kedei achilas pras, the minimum amount of time that we assume eating takes. Those of you that remember the halachas of the Seder, we're 10 months away, 2 months away, depending on which way you're looking. Kedei achilas pras is the amount of time that we need to eat matzah, right? It's also the amount of time that we'd have to wait between small bite and small bite and Yom Kippur. Rabbi Chaim said none of it. If a person is ill, they should eat. Rabbi Shechter told me the same. Rabbi Shechter, as he heard it from Soloveitchik, as he heard it from Rabbi Chaim. So they questioned Rabbi Chaim. They said to him, "Why are you so makil? Why are you so lenient in issues of Yom Kippur? Yom Kippur! Yom Kippur! Yom Kodesh V'Naira! The holiest day of the Jewish calendar, and you're being lenient? How could you be?" Says Rabbi Chaim, "I am not being makil in Yom Kippur. I'm being machmir in Pikuach Nefesh. I'm being stringent and the laws of life-saving. Both of these are values. I'm being machmir when it comes to pikuach nefesh." That's one insight into the brilliance and sensitivity of Rabbi Chaim. Story number two. Rabbi Chaim in his lifetime was known to a select elite few as a genius. That's how we know him. But in Brisk, he was known as the father of all the widows and orphans. In Brisk, he was known as a tremendous Baal Chesed. They tell a story that three great Rashi Yeshiva and Rabbanim were sitting around a table discussing the job of a rabbi. And one of them argued that the job of a rabbi is to teach Torah. Teach Torah. And one of them argued that the job of a rabbi is to pasken shailos, is to help people to know halacha. Reb Chaim sat at their table and said that the job of a rabbi is not to pasken shailos, is not to teach Torah. Of course it's those two. But most importantly, to be there for those that are in need. That was Reb Chaim's legacy in his lifetime. So much so that they say about Reb Chaim that people would walk into his house all day and all night. He once walked in and found an ani, a poor person, sleeping in his bed. Rather than waking him, Reb Chaim slept on the floor. They say that when the people of Brisk would give him money, would give him his paycheck, they had to give it to his Rebbetzin because money never stayed with him for any time longer than the next poor person he saw. There's a story that they tell of Reb Chaim, story in a story. There's a story that they tell of Reb Chaim that there were two people that wanted to thank him for something in particular, and they gave him an envelope. And inside the envelope was apparently a handsome sum of money. And an ani knocks on the door, asking for a donation, for a contribution. Reb Chaim, without even opening the envelope, just hands it to him. So they questioned him. They said, Rabbi, Reb Chaim, why do you have a door on your house? You don't use it. It's never closed. Why is the door there? Says Reb Chaim, because according to the shita of the Rambam, according to the opinion of a Rambam, you are only chayiv in mezuzah midaraisa if you have a door. You are only obligated in the mitzvah of mezuzah if you have a door. Without a door, you're chayiv midarabanan, you're obligated rabbinically. But in order to be obligated biblically, you need to have a door. He says, therefore I have a door. Now I don't know, again, how much of that was tongue-in-cheek or real. But it certainly says something about the person that revolutionized the way that we study Torah. He was known as Rav HaChesed. And that's what it says on his tombstone. Rav HaChesed, the Rabbi of Kindness. His son, Rav Elbel Soloveitchik, tells the story that there was one time that somebody walked into the house and they were learning as they did. Like the Rav used to say, the Rambam had his house slippers in my grandfather's house. There was always learning going on. And Rav Elbel is sitting writing Chidushei Torah. He's writing something. And somebody comes in and says, does anybody have a pen to borrow? And Rav Elbel says, hold on a minute, let me finish the sentence. Says Reb Chaim, what, we don't lend pens in this house anymore? We don't lend pens? Rav HaChesed, the Rabbi of Kindness. That was his legacy in his life. Of course, it's much more than that. Now, as I mentioned to you before, Reb Chaim never wrote anything himself. None of his Chidushei Torah were published in his lifetime. And the question, of course, is why? Why did he never publish anything? Years after he died, primarily by Rav Elbel Soloveitchik, Chidushei Reb Chaim al Rambam was published. And in the Hakdama, in the introduction to the book, his children, Rav Elbel and Rav Moshe, talk about their father's insistence in perfect truth and accuracy. If you take a look at the page, it's a little blurry up on the screen, but the page in front of you will have it. Take a look at the top line. We won't read through all of this inside, but just a little bit. V'hineh ha-sefer hazeh, this book, Chidush Rabbeinu Chaim al HaRambam, asher anachnu notnim lifneichem hayom, that we are giving to you today, rabot amal bo, Adonainu, Avinu, Moreinu, Rabbeinu, Hagon, Achasid. Such a tremendous amount of work that went into this. V'nasa nafsei alav b'shnosav achronos, and he gave his life for this work in the later years of his life. They go on to explain how he would write and rewrite and rewrite and rewrite every single word, every single sentence. That he would have somebody, he would dictate the words that he wanted written, and they would write pages and pages and pages, and he would pick them up and look at them and say, no, it's not accurate, tear it up and throw it out. Total accuracy. He was nervous of getting anything wrong. Reb Chaim was a perfectionist. To a certain extent, we might argue, it was simultaneously his greatest strength and his greatest weakness, his greatest loss, as far as we are concerned. Because those that have studied Reb Chaim argue that if he would have published it himself in his life, we would have had so much more clarity to it. The fact that it was published posthumously means that so much of the flavor of Reb Chaim, so much of the explanations that would have helped us to understand his incredible ideas, was lost. Down at the bottom of the page, this is taken from two different pieces in the introduction. Let me find it for you. Three lines, if you take a look at the break of the in the middle of the page, three lines in the middle of the line, v'loi. V'loi shakat v'loi nach v'loi zaz meha'inyan ad shihotzi kol davar la'amitoi ula'orai. He would never rest from a matter until he believed that he was completely, thoroughly, accurately done with it. V'az pana li'inyanim acherim, and then he would only turn his attention to other matters. V'acharei kol hanal, and after all of this, adain loy nacha dato. Even after all of his toil and all of his pursuit of truth and accuracy, his mind was never at rest. V'yashoked tomid al k'tavav letaknam, he would pore over his writings to fix them. L'agiham ul'raktam ul'nafosam, to correct them, to sift them, to sort them, to edit them. Vinifai called the man Nafa, and everything was gone over hundreds of times. Until he had fine-tuned it with perfection. La'amita shel Torah, according to the truth of Torah that he was capable of achieving with his brilliant mind. And this is his work. And here they issue an instruction to those that are going to learn this book. You should understand this, those that learn and those that delve into its depths. This is not like other books that can be acquired with a simple reading or even a study. Rak Sefer Shel Limud. It is a book that one should learn, not simply read, but to learn. She'ena nikne rak b'yegia v'iyun v'amal rav k'darka shel Torah. One can only acquire it, one can only understand it, one can only assimilate this into oneself through real study, through toil, through hard work. V'ashrei mi shiyamad al mitason ve'umkan shel dvarim. Happy is he or she that works to understand this. Gam acharei hayegiva iyun hamaruba binu zais. After all the toil, and one should understand this carefully. Such is the haskama, the introduction of Reb Chaim Halevi's work on the Rambam. Not simply a book to read, but a book to study, where every single word is measured, is meted out. We'll see in a moment how this brilliance, the sensitivity to language, to verbiage, to words, now forms such a central focus in our world of study. And to that end, I will introduce you to a brilliant work called Ishim V'Shittas. Ishim V'Shittas was written as articles originally, and then collected and published by Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin. Rav Zevin, at some point in time, we should probably do a people of the book about him by himself, was a Hasidish Jew, a Lubavitch Jew, that wrote intellectual biographies of Litvisha Gedolim and Rosh Yeshiva. A Lubavitch Jew that wrote about Reb Chaim, about the Netziv, about the Rogachava, many others, intellectual biographies, understanding the way that they thought. And he has a beautiful chapter on Reb Chaim, and we'll take some excerpts from it. Let's see if we can zoom in here. Ah, there we go. Hold on. The first is the story. And the story they tell as follows. Rav Yechezkel Abramsky and one other rabbi who is unnamed in the story is sitting in Rav Chaim's home in Brisk. And they're learning, they're discussing. There's a knock at the door. And a man walks in, upset, livid. Why? His brother had passed away that very morning. His brother had died, a poor man. And an hour after his brother had died, a very wealthy man had died in Brisk. And the Chevra Kedisha buried the wealthy man first. Now we should all know the din. God forbid when somebody dies, they're buried right away. And whoever dies first is buried first. And that's the job of the Chevra Kedisha, to make sure of this. To take care of this halacha. And the man is livid. And he says to Reb Chaim, what should we do? Read them the riot act. Not fair. Says Reb Chaim, bring me a Rambam Hilchas Avelus. So they brought him a Rambam Hilchas Avelus. And he opens up the Rambam, Laws of Mourning, flicks through it, and he looks at the man and says to him as follows. You are 100% right. The Chevra Kedisha should be dealt with. But it's none of your business. Go home and sit shiva. You are right, but it's none of your business. So Rav Yechezkel Abramsky, who's sitting there, says to him, Rabbi Soloveitchik, what do you mean? Either he's right, in which case this is his business, or he's wrong and it's none of his business. And furthermore, Rabbi Chezkel Abramsky was a Gaon Olam in his own right. He says, the Rambam in his Hilchos Avelus, in the Laws of Mourning, does not mention this law. The law of who gets buried first. What are you doing? Says Rav Chaim, and listen to this beautiful answer, the brilliance of this answer. He says as follows. I have a question, a chakira, a logical debate. How do we define this halacha? And this is an example of beautiful Brisk alumnus, beautiful Brisk analysis. The halacha of he who dies first is buried first. Is this a law that is unique to the laws of mourning? Or is this an example of the general category of laws? Mitzvah haba liyadcha al tachmitzena. If a mitzvah comes your way, don't tarry, do it right away. What is this law? Is it a din in avelus? Is it a law in the laws of mourning? Or a din ba'alma? Or is it simply a regular law? So I opened up the Rambam. And I noticed that in no place in Hilchas Avelus, in the Rambam's Laws of Mourning, does he mention this halacha. That he who dies first is buried first. Therefore I conclude that the Rambam is of the opinion that is a din ba'alma. It is an expression of the general rule. Hence I said to the man, he is right, for he is. But it's none of his business. This is not a law specific to the laws of mourning. Hence I told him to go home. It's my job as the Rav of Brisk to deal with the Chevra Kedisha. It has nothing to do with him. Is it a din in Avelus or a din ba'alma? Is it a law specific to the laws of mourning or a general law? Says Rav Abramsky, Rav Chaim Halevi Soloveitchik, not only learns laws from what the Rambam says, he learns laws from what the Rambam doesn't say. The brilliance of Rav Chaim. Our next story. This is simply to illustrate the methodology of learning of Reb Chaim. The halacha is as follows. If a person, for some reason, is unable to daven shachris, they're stuck on a plane, they're not feeling well, God forbid they have an operation, there's a legitimate reason they are not able to daven shachris. What should they do? What's the din? Who knows? What's the din? Make it up in mincha, right? You daven mincha again, right? Daven two minchas. What we call in the Gemara's word for this is tashlumim, make up. You make it up. Now, when daven's the same Shemoneh Esrei twice, for example, if a person forgot to say, forgot mincha of Rosh Chodesh, when they say make it up in Maariv, they don't now say Yalav Yova, right? Because now it's a different day. Yalav Yova is no longer applicable. But there is somewhat of an interesting exception. A man came to Reb Chaim and says to him, what do I do? Matzei Shabbos. Matzei Shabbos, I forgot Maariv. And in Maariv, what do we say on Matzei Shabbos, special tefillah? Atachon Antonu, Havdalah. We say Havdalah in Maariv. There's a paragraph in Atachonin Adam Das, in the bracha of Chonin Hadas, we add in Havdalah. So the man says to Reb Chaim, what do I do? I left out, I forgot to say Maariv on Matzah Shabbos, I was unable to say Maariv on Matzah Shabbos, so now I'm going to say two Shachris. When should you say Atachon Antonu? The first one or the second one? Which one is to make up Maariv? The second one. Says Reb Chaim, that's the Chakira. Is it about saying Atachon Antonu in Maariv, or is it about making Havdalah in the first tefillah after Shabbos? He says it's about making Havdalah in the first tefillah after Shabbos. He says, therefore, that's why you said in Shachris Shmana Esrei, the first opportunity. For that is the tefillah that you're saying right after Shabbos. It's not Maariv anymore, it's Shachris. And the Maariv that you say is now going to be Maariv after. See if we can get one more here. There is a wealth of literature and much ink spilt. Why Reb Chaim never wrote Shaila Zetshuvos? Why he never authored responsa? Hundreds of people asked him questions. He gave hundreds of answers, thousands. He never wrote Shaila Zetshuvos. And there are those that argued, and they would not be entirely wrong, argues Rav Zevin, that this is to a certain extent resultant from Reb Chaim's unwillingness to submit himself to one particular point of view. His ever-changing nature, his ever-expanding understandings, made it hard to nail him down to one particular opinion. Says Rav Zevin, he thinks that it's more. Rav Zevin argues that Reb Chaim was so brilliant and so innovative, and yet simultaneously so humble, that he did not want to paskin because he knew he would think differently from almost everyone else. His methodology and his rationale would force him to see things in ways that other people did not see, and he did not want to go against the norm in establishing Shaila Zetshuvos, in establishing responsa literature. An example to this, Rav Zevin quotes a story that there was a particular debate that went on with regards to one story involving Gittin, involving a case of divorce. That Reb Chaim decided to forward this shaila, to forward this question to Reb Yitzchak Elchanan in Kovna. But he requested that Reb Yitzchak Elchanan only put his bottom line answer and not his rationale behind it. He requested that Rav Yitzchak Elchanan not tell him why he would patskin, why he would decide halach in a certain way. Argues Rav Zevin, because Rav Chaim knew that if Rav Yitzchak Elchanan would have cited his sources and explained his rationale, that Rav Chaim would have been unable to accept the psak unless he completely agreed with it. To accept the authority of Rav Yitzchak Elchanan, he was happy to do. To accept the rationale was impossible. Either it was true to Rav Chaim's brilliant analytical mind, or it was not. And to that end, Rav Chaim would rather just be able to say, this is what Rav Yitzchak Elchanan says, without knowing his rationale. Now there's a beautiful article written by Rav Moshe Lichtenstein, the son of Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Zichrono Livracha. It's the Rav's grandson, which makes him, of course, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik's great-great-grandson. He wrote a beautiful article, What Hath Brisk Wrought? The Brisk Derech Revisited. And there's some pieces that I've included in the handout. You'll be able to read that. This is excerpts. Simply excerpts. We'll read a tiny bit of it inside, but then we must carry on. The net result of Reb Chaim's approach is the creation of thought constructs, which are far removed from the practical concerns of the Pasek. Seeking the practical implications and application of a particular sugya, thereby shifting the emphasis of the Beis Medrash from a practical halachic orientation to an ideal theoretical one. Reb Chaim dissolved all of halacha into categories, into keywords. And we'll give one example. And please feel free to read through the rest of this. Let me ask you a question. A man comes up to me and he says, Rabbi, I have no ability to put on tefillin for the next 2 weeks. I'm going to be very busy with work, with business, whatever the case is. Can you please put on tefillin for me? Every day after davening, when you take off your tefillin, put them back on again, make another bracha, and say, I'm doing this for Chaim Shmerl. Please put on tefillin for me. Does it work? No go. No go, right? Let's say I have a field in Eretz Yisrael. And my field in Eretz Yisrael is growing beautiful fruit. And I say to my friend, do me a favor, can you please separate the trumas of maestros from this field? Can you take off the tithe? Do me a favor, instead of me tithing it, you tithe it. Does it work? Yes. I say to somebody, can you give this $20 to tzedakah for me? Does it work? How come it doesn't work for tefillin?
Something, have a brisk for me. I mean, it doesn't work.
So there are thousands of ways of explaining. You're 100% right. Before Reb Chaim to answer this question, you could have done it in 10 lines, in 20 lines. Reb Chaim does it in 4 words. Chovas ha-gavra, chovas ha-cheftza. One is an obligation on the person. One is an obligation on the item. Tefillin, bris milah, chovas hagavra, you have to do it. You have to do it yourself. Can't have somebody else do it for you. But a chovas hachefza, so that needs to be done, does not require you to do it. It requires that it be done, a chovas hachefza. Reb Chaim could categorize a wealth of halachic information into 2 words. Gavra chafza. You can see why this is attractive. More than anybody else, what Reb Chaim introduced, and there's so many examples. Siman versus Siba. Is A cause of B? Or is A just prevalent in the case of B? Siman and Siba. Maise and Kium. Doing a mitzvah versus fulfilling a mitzvah. Big question in halacha. When does a person fulfill the obligation of having a child? It's a mitzvah puruvu. Usually there's 9 months apart. When does a person fulfill that mitzvah? There's a maise and there's a kium. Maise and kium. There's an activity, a maise, and a kium, a fulfillment. A maise and a kium. A siman and a siba. A cause and a relationship. Siman and a siba. These buzzwords took over the yeshiva world. Took over the yeshiva world like a storm. And Reb Chaim's methodology, probably much more than his chidushim, his methodology is adopted throughout the world. Reb Chaim's way of thinking allows people to analyze texts, breaking them down to their logical components. Now, it should be noted that the Gemara does this in some cases by itself. But Reb Chaim expands this to all areas of halacha. And this takes over the yeshivish world because it provides people with a toolbox, a guide, a way of approaching a sugya, a new topic in learning, and telling people, you can analyze it, you can break it down. Those that are interested to take a look further in Rav Moshe Lichtenstein's article, feel free to Google it, you'll see the whole thing. Brisk is interested in the what questions. What is this? As opposed to the why. Definitions, structure, building blocks of logic. It is for this reason that Reb Chaim's detractors called his methodology chemistry. Chemistry. Reb Chaim's detractors argued that he was reducing the process of being a Talmid Chacham, of being a knowledgeable scholar in Torah, to being a scientist. And they said that in a very derogatory fashion. That the danger of Brisk, the danger of Reb Chaim's methodology, is that it was so attractive that people would start making chakiras, would start making logical conjectures without knowing anything. Would see things and build ideas, build logic without enough information. And to that end, there are many that argued that rather than learning Brisker lumdus, Brisker methodology, one needs to first and foremost be baki, be an expert in all of Jewish text. In Mishnah, in Gemara, in Shulchan Aruch, in Rishonim, in Achronim. That a person needs to have a wealth of knowledge before they can start conjecting. For a person can start building structures and not know that against their logical construction, there's a Gemara in another place that they've never heard about. Or a Yerushalmi that disagrees. Or the Rambam himself says exactly the opposite in another place. That the danger of Brisk is that people will abandon structured learning in the pursuit of beautiful logic. Now, of course, the world of Brisk is something that we are all intensely familiar with because of those that have taught it to us. Reb Chaim has two children that become exceedingly famous in their own right. Reb Moshe Soloveitchik, the father of the Rav, who makes his way to America and becomes a Rosh Yeshiva at Ritz. Rabbi Rakevet argues that we have so little biographical information about Rav Moshe as we do, as opposed to the Rav. But of course his brother, instead of coming to America, makes his way to Eretz Yisrael. Rav Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik, known as the Brisker Rav, noticed that there is a difference of a T in the spelling of their last names. The Brisker Rav builds up the Yeshiva's Brisk in Yerushalayim. His methodology closely resembling that of his father. But when it comes to the world of Halacha, I'll just add this one vignette. One short anecdote that the Brisker Rav is well known for his love of chumras, of stringencies in Jewish law. He himself practiced many, many, many stringencies. Why? Because in a world of logical constructs where everything has a valid idea, everything has a valid point, the Brisker Rav, as he was known, found it hard to choose between different opposing ideas in halakha and would attempt to practice all of them. This is the custom in Brisker yeshivas today, and it's well known that the Brisker Rav, even though he lived in Me'er Sharim, observed 2 days of Yom Tov. Why? He lived in Israel. Says the Brisker Rav, it might well have been that the emissaries that were sent from the temple to inform people that Rosh Chodesh has happened, they would never have passed his house. And were he to be living in temple times, he might not have known when Rosh Chodesh was, when the new month was, and therefore might have needed to keep 2 days of Yom Tov even in Me'er Sharim. Such was his concern for minute details of halacha. It should also be noted that his students once found him on Sukkot eating fruit and shehakel things outside of the sukkah. They said to him, Rebbe, you keep every chumra in the book. Now, we know that you're not required al pi din, al pi halacha, according to the strict letter of the law, to drink every glass of water inside the sukkah, but you keep every chumra. You keep every stringency. Why not this one? He says, because all the chumras that I keep are possibilities that that could be the din. Possibilities that the law might be so. When it comes to having a glass of water outside of the sukkah, there is no valid halachic authority to say that it must be done. Therefore, I see no reason to keep that chumrah. Every chumrah I keep is because it might be the truth. It might be halacha. Such was the opinion of the Brisker Rav. Of course, we can do very little, certainly in Boca Raton, without talking about Moreno Rabbeinu, Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik, the Rav. And the Rav's contribution to American Jewry and to our community is well known and well spoken about, and at some point in time, I'm sure we will have many, many shiurim about the Rav. Please God, in upcoming years, as I know there have been in the past, I'll share with you three tiny things. Perhaps just one, depending, yeah, we're running out of time. / we might already be out. I'll give you one more. There's a story that I recently heard. The Rav would fly from Boston to New York to give shiur in YU. He would come, I believe, on a Tuesday and leave on a Thursday. And I heard a story from one of his Talmidim that one Thursday, he gave a tremendous shiur, beautiful shiur, Chulin Daf Ches. And the next Tuesday when he came into yeshiva, he opened up the Gemara and he gave a shiur on Chulin Daf Ches. And he gave a completely different approach. A new, novel, beautiful way of explaining the Gemara. And his student said to him, Rebbe, why did you do that? The shiur on Thursday was fantastic. You came in on Tuesday to give a shiur on the same daf of Gemara. Completely different shiur. He says, what's going on? He says, Shabbos afternoon, I was in Boston. I was sitting on the couch and I dozed off. And I saw in my mind's eye a picture of my father, of Moshe, walking slowly towards me. And in his hand was a Gemara. In his hands was a Gemara, and he opened the Gemara. And he pointed to Chulin Daf Ches, what we had just learnt. And he says, Beryl, you can do better. Beryl, think harder, you can do better. He says, I woke up with a start. And for the next numerous hours, I relearned and relearned and relearned the Gemara until I came to a better understanding of it. And this is the shiur that I gave on that Tuesday morning. Shutz was the depth of truth, the brilliance, the desire for accuracy of Brisk. Of course, we'll have no time to talk about Rav Aaron Soloveitchik in Chicago, the Brisker of children, Rav Meshulam David Soloveitchik, the Rosh Yeshiva of Brisk in Yerushalayim, and the Brisker of his grandson, Rav Avram Yeshua Soloveitchik, the son of Rav Beryl Soloveitchik, both of whom are running Yeshiva's Brisk in Yerushalayim today. Undoubtedly, the three biggest contributions that Brisk has given us is an accuracy for emes, an accuracy for halacha, an accuracy for learning, the desire to have it perfect, an overwhelming sensitivity to other people, that one cannot deny the needs of others, even with a tremendous amount of learning, and of course a beautiful analytical, logical methodology. Please God, we should all be zeicher to grow in all these three areas. Have a wonderful evening.